Hi, this is Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn. It's Tuesday, April 10th, and we just heard on the news Don Imus in a load of trouble, and this story is taking off quickly as it would. Race and sex in the remarks, inappropriate. He's apologized. He has called his two-week suspension an appropriate disciplinary action, but has also not too zealously, but has defended himself to some extent just on the Today Show, I think it was this morning. So we're going to talk about it this hour. What did Don Imus do? How serious was it? Was the punishment appropriate? Who makes these kinds of rules, especially when it comes to comedy and satire and what can and can't be said? Are they social rules? Are they FCC rules? And who makes them and who enforces them? Well, with us to talk this hour is John Pavlik. He's professor and chair of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. And not coincidentally, we called John Pavlik because of his expertise, but also he's got a front row seat here because the Rutgers University women's basketball team was the target of Don Imus's remarks. We'd like to hear your remarks this hour. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number. Once again, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, as I am, you can dial the local number, 414-227-2050. John Pavlik, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And, as I said, you have a special vantage point there at Rutgers, don't you? How are things on campus?
Well, it's been a lot of turmoil, really. The team, of course, was celebrated in its success in the tournament and finishing second after a spectacular season. And then to have this happen right after that really took the wind out of everybody's sails. And so here there's been just an outcry as a response and people calling for his resignation.
Yeah, and as I said, both racial and sexual slurs, and I'll say this once and maybe say it again later. I hate to repeat these phrases, but the phrase in question here, we have to say it at least a couple times, nappy-headed hoes. So both, as I say, both a racial and a sexual slur. He has apologized. Do you think his apology was sufficient?
No, I don't. I've been going over this at great length thinking about it, and there's so many issues, of course, that you have to balance. You have to balance the First Amendment against the responsibilities that broadcasters have, and the free use of the public airwaves carries a certain responsibility that is written into the federal legislation to serve in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. But I struggled over this and we talked about it at length. I just, did a class this morning. We talked about it with the students at length and our journalism and media studies students. And I thought about it, but what if I said something like that? Well, the fact is that either I'd be fired but before I'd be fired, I would resign. I'd have to give up my position as chair and I'd have to, not be in that position of that kind of visibility and influence where you're providing a voice for that kind of unacceptable viewpoint, racist, sexist viewpoint. So that convinced me that really the logical thing for him to do would be to resign, and if he doesn't resign, for the cancellation of his show. Even though at the same time, his show hasn't been, always one of the worst shows on the air. Sometimes it's one of the best shows on the air, but he has a history of having made other racist comments in the past. So, and sexist comments in the past.
Yeah, and he's been called on it, and his past is coming up in this current argument, but he's never been disciplined to this extent. Are they basing this discipline on, I don't know the answer to this, is there something in his contract about this, or are they kind of making this up as they go along?
Well, and I haven't seen his contract.
Is there typically something in someone like Imus? I know I don't have anything in my contract, or maybe I do. I'll have to read it a little more carefully. But is it typical to put this kind of thing in an employment agreement, or are we just relying on the FCC and relying on our own common sense?
It would be typical to include some language about the appropriateness of what's presented, but it would focus tend to focus on obscenity rather than a race or gender-related issues.
Yeah. What about the role of comedy and satire and how that change? It does change things, but to what extent does it change issues of freedom of speech?
Well, I think that we've had a number of incidents recently of media figures who've made racist comments. Michael Richards, the comedian, most visibly of late, and he took a firestorm of criticism for having made racist comments during a comedy routine in a nightclub. And of course, subsequently, he apologized in ways that some found acceptable, some did not. But I think that in this case, there's increased sensitivity to people in visible positions through the media making racist comments. And I've seen most of the reaction has been over his racist comments and not the sexist comments, but I think they're equally offensive in this case. So I think he should be taken to task on both counts. But I think it's because of the recent sensitivity, the fact that we've had this as a public discourse. That's why when he made comments in the past that were racist or sexist, there wasn't as much of an outcry.
Yeah. And not the Richards case specifically or this case specifically, but just generally speaking, increased sensitivity could also be stated as oversensitive. Is there a point where we get too, some people will say, too sensitive, too politically correct? And how do we guard against that?
Well, I think that could happen. You certainly don't want to discourage people from being able to talk about issues that might involve race or gender. You know, if we get to that point where you're just afraid to ever say anything, then, we stifle the discourse, and that would be a bad thing for society to not be able to talk about these issues. But I think that where you draw the line would be when someone is saying something, like in this case, which is clearly meant to be making explicit ridicule.
Right.
And, these students, I don't think there's any basis for them to deserve that kind of racist ridicule or sexist ridicule.
And my central question that I really want to continue to kick around throughout the hour with you and with callers is who makes these rules and how are they enforced? In your mind, are these the kind of rules that happen, that grow up naturally out of public mores, or are they the kind of rules that can be stated as policy of either the government or an agency or an employer?
Well, partly they're mores. I mean, that's where part of it comes from, but partly it's policy and it's law. And I would argue in this case that there's no place for the government to censor Mr. Imus or censor CBS on this matter. There's no place for there to be what's called prior restraint, that they could prevent them from having these kind of discourse. So I don't think it's the role of the government to take the action. I think it's really just the responsibility of the media to take action in this case. So although there is a place for government action and responsibility, in this case, I think it's really up to the media to respond.
And people like Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. Jesse Jackson led a demonstration yesterday. Al Sharpton had Imus on his radio, on Sharpton's radio program yesterday, both, as you would imagine, being highly critical. That's the kind of pressure you expect and would think is appropriate. I mean, nobody wants to put him in jail, but they do really want to call him out in a strong way.
Right. Well, I saw part of a video of his talking with Reverend Sharpton, and I didn't find it a particularly satisfying apology.
Well, neither did Sharpton.
I thought Imus was almost defiant in apologizing, and it was strange, I thought.
Yeah, well, as I read the account, Sharpton didn't think much of it either, did he?
No, apparently not.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and take some callers. Jan is calling from Marshfield. Let's start with you. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. I want to say, too, Peter, you do a great job filling in.
Thanks.
I watched a little bit of it last night and this morning, and I was just really angry. I agree with Sharpton and some of the other people that were on that something more needs to be done than a two-week suspension, and I think what your guest just said, that maybe the network or some, they have to do something, because it's like he reminded me of Howard Stern. It was just disgusting. And I guess, why are we allowing that on the public airwaves? And also, I'd like to make a comment about James Carville, who was on this morning. And he said, well, Don is a friend of his, so he probably would go on the show. I think the Democrats need to think long and hard, or any candidate, long and hard about going on that show with him if he does get back on. Because I think there's a lot of anger out there.
Jan, thanks for your call. Yeah, a couple of other regulars. I think Joe Biden was mentioned, John McCain. He's had some high-powered guests on his program. What do you think will happen there?
Well, I think that a lot of those guests will decide not to go on, because it'll, especially if there's people who are concerned about future elections and what will happen in 2008, I think there could be consequences on voter reaction, seeing them going on a show like that, that they may be associated with that kind of racist or sexist views.
Yeah. Do you see the FCC, and forgive me, I know you alluded to this a little earlier, but I want to elaborate. Do you see the FCC ever stepping in beyond obscenity and into areas like this?
Well, I'll probably be wrong, you know, when you try to predict, but I don't think so, at least not in the near term. I think that they will continue to, for the most part, limit their fines and actions to obscenity or related topics if media got somehow involved. And I couldn't imagine it happened, but if they got involved in child pornography or something like that, they would immediately take action, revoke licenses and things of that nature. But for this sort of thing, I doubt it.
So the kinds of pressure we see now, just public demonstration, criticism from other parts of the media, that's the way we should enforce these things.
Well, I didn't say that, but I said I doubt if there would be any action beyond that.
Oh, so you'd like?
Would
you?
Could do.
Would you like to see the FCC? I should have asked it another way. Would you like to see the FCC turn to these areas?
Well, it gets very, very complicated in terms of, freedom of expression issues. You don't want to muzzle the media, make the media feel any more muzzled than they are already. It's not a good time in terms of media and society. But I think that if the response of CBS and MSNBC does not advance and include much more, I think it would be appropriate for the FCC to do some sort of public hearings and consider further action. I think that would be appropriate, because I think what CBS and MSNBC have done so far and what IMUS has done so far has been inadequate.
Right. And just to make sure everyone is on the same page here, what we're talking about is Don Imus made a remark, a phrase I'm going to repeat only a couple times because it's uncomfortable, frankly. Nappy-headed hoes is how he referred to the Rutgers University women's basketball team, who came in second place in the championship over the weekend. And he has been suspended for 2 weeks by his bosses at MSNBC and CBS Radio. He's a nationally syndicated radio host. It's also aired on MSNBC, televised. And he's gone for 2 weeks. A lot of people think that's not enough, that he should be fired. Our guest even saying that it might be appropriate for the FCC to get into these kinds of areas. What do you think? Who makes the rules, and how do they get enforced? Your call's welcome at 800-486-8655, and we'll be right back after this quick break. Peter Donalds here, in for Kathleen Dunn, joined by John Pavlik, Journalism and Media Studies at Rutgers University, talking about the Imus story. What do you think? His punishment severe enough? Should he be fired, as many are calling for? And your call is welcome, 800-486-8655. And let's go back to those calls. Liz is in Milwaukee. Hi, Liz.
Hi. This is getting, it's very interesting. We talk about not wanting to muzzle the truth, but we can still talk about how that truth is expressed in ways that really tear us down as people. And I'd like to just mention two things. I promised the screener I'd be careful with this. I used to listen to Imus occasionally in the morning, and at one time he was saying that one politician must have done someone a favor And he stated it by saying, oh, he must have had his face in someone's lap. And it took me a while to figure out what he said, and I'm not going to explain what I finally figured out he said. But it was like, well, now, wait a minute. That's not a very good way to put it. And then the other thing is, on the other hand, on the conservative side, we have Rush Limbaugh, who, if he doesn't like what a woman says, he calls her a lesbian. And, you know, and that's caught on. People go, oh, you know, if you have a hard line and you're a woman, you must be a lesbian. And, you know, not saying those things, that's not the same as muzzling the truth. And, you know, I think we have to try to look at it in a different way. No, we don't want to stop the truth from getting out, but how do we do it and still be human beings and not degrade each other? I mean, is there a way to do that?
Okay, Liz, that's a great question and a big, big question. How do we do that, John Pavlik?
Well, I don't have a simple answer for it, but
I think so.
That we need to accept and tolerate the offensive speech that we will hear at times, but there also needs to be avenues for response and discourse. And in a case like this one, there's no direct avenue for the public to respond. They're just sort of forced to, you know, accept whatever discourse might be on Imus's show. They can choose not to listen, you know, but that's about all they can do. They can go on their own web blog, or they can go in someplace and post comments. They can do things like that. The important thing here, though, is, you know, I just drawing on another case. This goes back more than 75 years. It was called a Supreme Court case, Neer versus Minnesota, where Neer was an anti-Semitic publisher who said some horrible things. But the government ruled, the Supreme Court ruled, that there should be no prior restraint on the media. And I think that's the principle that we need to maintain, that the government can't prevent or block you from saying something. But there can be consequences when you cross the line that I think Mr. Imus did. And fines are a possibility, or other kinds of action.
And we should be clear. I guess it's obvious, but sometimes you need to state the obvious. We're talking about this because it is the public airwaves. Now, if Imus, like Howard Stern, had moved over to satellite radio, we wouldn't be talking about this today. It's in the nature of the public airwaves that this debate occurs, right?
Well, that's right. The airwaves have been given to media, licensed to media to use at no cost, no charge from the government for those licenses. But in return, the media are expected to act in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. Those are the key words. And their licenses have to be renewed. And if they don't act responsibly, if they're not serving the community interest, their license can be revoked, and that has happened in the past.
Right.
There can also be fines.
And with that, let's go to West Allis and talk with Milton. Hi, Milton.
Hi. Okay, I'd like an extra minute or two this morning. I usually keep my comments short, but I'd like to ask for an extra minute or two.
Well, you know what? Now, we got a long line of calls, so extra minute or two denied. But give me what you got.
Okay, now to start out with, the FCC basically has no power to regulate language anymore, based on a court decision in an FCC ruling last November. So, you know, that's pretty much gutted. Please have a show on this. Millions of black people say things like nappy-headed hoes every day, usually with just as much malicious intent as Imus could ever muster. And those folks don't care a fig if a rich old propagandist says it. And I'll bet the team coach has called the players worse.
Okay, Milton, I'm going to leave it at that and get a comment from our guest. Let's start with the last thing. And Imus himself said this, that the term originated in the black community. Does that give him any kind of defense?
I don't really think so. I think that when he used the phrase, he didn't put it in any context. He was just having fun and making fun of the team, ridiculing them, and using that as a convenient way in their little banter that he had going on the show. It was just meant as part of a comedy.
Yeah, there's a book out now and a show we did recently, just I think earlier this week or last week, on the N-word. And that's part of that debate all the time, that there are ways to use the N-word within the black community that are still accepted. Is it somehow, and I don't know, maybe we're getting out of your area here, but is it somehow a double standard that one group can use a word and another group can't?
I think it's about context.
Yeah.
We can use those phrases in this discussion because
right.
we've put them in context and given them meaning. When you take them out of context, just about anything can be taken and then misused and become very offensive when put in another venue.
Right. And that goes back to my question earlier about what changes the context when you're dealing with comedy and satire. It certainly is recognized that does change the context. Imus himself said it was a failed attempt at comedy.
Well, sure, and there are things you can do on comedy on radio, over-the-air radio, and over-the-air television, but you have very different boundaries than you would have, as you mentioned earlier, on pay cable or pay satellite radio or television or even online.
Right.
The boundaries are different, and he's experienced. He's been around for many years.
Oh,
he
yeah.
knows what the boundaries are.
Yep. And let's go to Milton's first point. Can you fill us in about this FCC ruling in November that pretty much gutted any rules about language? What's Milton talking about there? Do you know? John? Pavlik?
I'm not familiar with a specific ruling from last November in that regard.
Okay, I'll have to look into that because according to Milton, there aren't any more language rules. So stay tuned for the next half hour and we'll see what I say.
I don't know that to be the case.
I'll test it. Thanks for the call, Milton. Steve's calling from Houston. Steve, you in Houston, Texas?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
I love it when people call from around the country. Welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Internet's a wonderful thing. I used to live in Wisconsin. I listen to you on the radio there all over, but I'm grateful to have you here. We don't have anything like public radio here, unfortunately.
Oh, okay.
I'm thinking about the law of unintended consequences, if you can call it that, because in Houston we have a lot of problems in the inner city. Yesterday was a 14-year-old girl dragged off from middle school and raped. And I guess, in the eyes of the person who did that, she was just a little black hole. And, I think about this, and the reality is that, the African community is inundated, sadly, with music day in. I listen to it all the time. I drive around. I listen to it. I'm forced to listen to it blaring out of these cars of music that just talks about women like little whores. It treats a woman like whores. So, I guess my point is, I hope that this becomes a revolution of conscience in this country, where people stand up and say enough, enough. That you're calling our women whores and prostitutes, enough of a drug. Saturated sex, saturated culture that takes our girls at younger and younger ages and sexualizes them, and stimulates men, to act like this. I mean, he's just expressing things that I hear day in and day out. I really hope that beginning with public radio and beginning in the pulpits and beginning in this nation, we look at these issues because there's consequences of a culture that allows this kind of thing to come day in and day out in our schools. I see men, boys all the time walking around with their pants hanging down. In Houston, sadly, there are kids getting raped in the schools almost every month. And I pulled my kids out of public school for that reason, because it's almost a lawless mass of anarchy in the schools. And music, is central to our kids' lives.
Yeah, it sure is. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I want to get a response. A degraded culture. This is a sign of that. John Pavlik.
Well, it's certainly a part of that whole milieu. There's no question that we've got a music environment and a culture where there's a lot of degradation of women, and that's a fact. But I'm reluctant to blame necessarily the media for that. I think the media reflect that. I don't know that they are the cause of it, but they certainly contribute to it, and they may reinforce some of that behavior. And I think what I would like to see come out of it, I'd like to see CBS and MSNBC provide perhaps fund some sort of a new program, a foundation or something that could actually help to provide some sort of forum for discussing these issues, and maybe doing something to build a curriculum for schools and do some sort of a venue to talk about these issues in an ongoing way.
And have you seen calls for that sort of thing? Is this will you be penning a letter to CBS and MSNBC?
I plan to approach them to talk about doing something like this, and we could do it in a venue beginning with Rutgers. But I wouldn't want to focus only on this case. because, as the caller said, it's a much bigger issue.
And as long as Steve has opened up the issue, why don't I let you muse for a while on the current state of and the talk industry? I include myself. I include the liberal and conservative, Air America and Rush Limbaugh, and also the cable TV industry. Have you seen trends in the last few years that bring us to today? In other words, a degradation of character or of rhetoric?
Well, I think that there has been an increasing sort of a talk radio culture where it's polarized, and where obviously the intent to get as much energy flowing as possible is the objective in order to draw in audiences. And they're always trying to push the boundaries. But that's the nature of media, of our media system going back for decades, is to continue to push the boundaries and to see where the boundaries are and at what point we find it, unacceptable to cross a certain boundary. So I think it's definitely the case that it's a polarized environment where the outrageous is often said, and that's part of why, I suppose, Howard Stern decided to move to satellite radio, so that he could try to push the boundaries even further and not have to worry as much about any regulatory consequences.
Can you foresee a world, and it's, I guess it's not that difficult, where there are more and more Howard Sterns and more digital venues that fall outside the authority of the FCC or any other regulating agency? And is that a good thing? I have a friend in the media industry who really comes down on the side of free speech. He wants more and more and more voices, and something like this IMUS incident probably wouldn't bother him at all. He'd say, go ahead, as long as there are, 100 other voices to criticize him, let everybody say what they want. Is there a world in our future where things like digital technologies are going to allow for that?
I think that there's a lot of sort of conflicting forces that are at work. With satellite radio, for example, they're taking sort of the cream of the audience crop away from terrestrial radio. You've got a more educated, more financially able audience that's paying for satellite radio. And some of what's on terrestrial radio does make its way onto satellite radio as well, but a lot of it doesn't. Traditional radio is being squeezed for our audience, especially the upper end financially of the audience. And so there's pressure on radio to maintain ratings. Audience ratings have been slipping for most radio over the past decade or more. And so there's pressure there. And so you've got pressure on talk radio, as any other part of radio, to maintain audience. But at the same time, the future of satellite radio is a little bit uncertain. They've proposed a merger between XM and Sirius, and there's no certain outcome in terms of getting the regulatory approval for that merger. They had to both agree to not merge in order to get their license in the first place. Whether they'll be able to get the FCC to change its position and allow the merger is unclear. Whether satellite radio will be a wild free-for-all is not clear yet, and whether the internet will be a completely unconstrained environment for this kind of material, I'm not certain that'll happen.
Right.
There was an announcement yesterday to try to get bloggers to be more civil.
Yeah. And we have the whole, net neutrality issue. And, the internet and satellite radio, two things that were supposed to be free-for-alls, as you say, that's not so certain anymore. And I think I can understand where free speech advocates like my friend I can understand that point of view. The more, the merrier. The more, the better. The more and the freer. As opposed to all of us, myself included, right now as I speak, my hands are tied 100 different ways on what I can say, about things. So let's go to Appleton and talk. Is it Steele?
Yes. I have a question on just people's opinions. An example, a few years ago when everyone, when the public was very excited, the Dixie Chicks make a comment of being embarrassed by a president, and then they're just vilified and taken down in demonstrations of running over their music and all. And if they had said that now, their sales would probably go through the roof. And
well, as they have. They just won a Grammy in their latest CDs.
I know, that's fantastic,
right.
But that's besides the point. They were vilified for speaking their mind earlier.
Right.
And they paid a heavy price. But just a comment on how moods change. And I remember when Shock and Awe first came, all the workers were excited and say, well, why don't we just nuke the sand niggers? Well, you know, there's all sorts of prevailing moods in this country, and I think people are playing their sensitivities too much. And it's up to you to teach nonviolent communication, not to have broadcasters sponsor classes.
Okay, Steele, thanks for the call. Response, John Pavlik?
Well, I think that the important thing is that the government should not be controlling the voice of, you know, the media, but we need to have venues for a public response. I think that if the public wants to boycott, you know, that's totally within their right. And if they want to organize a protest to the FCC to seek the revocation of a station's license, that's something that the public can do and has done in the past. But where I would be reluctant is to see the government try to start muzzling the media.
Do you see there's been some talk about the advertisers with MSNBC and CBS Radio. Have you heard the latest on that, if there's any impact on advertising yet?
Well, I haven't seen a specific report on specific advertisers who've withdrawn their support, but I think that may be coming and would certainly be a possible and appropriate response. And that kind of pressure is what media will respond to when things start affecting their bottom line.
Yeah, and I'm certain that letters are being drafted as we speak or have already been sent, emails. I bet those advertisers are already feeling the pressure. But no word yet on what they've decided to do.
I haven't seen any specific report yet.
Okay. Peter is calling from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Well, first thing, just get back to the music industry. The gentleman you have on said that it's hard to blame the media for the stuff that the music industry is coming out with. It's funny, when I go on TV to watch the Grammy Awards or pick up a Rolling Stone on how all these albums that glorify the word whore they talk about in the black community are winning Grammys and being written up in articles. What's the one quote here? I lost it now, but just saying and how free thinking and how ahead of their times there are on some of these albums that are being written. So I think the media's dove right into it and accepted it. That's my first point. I asked my 19-year-old kid this morning to go into his iPod and pick out. I wanted to see how many songs he had on there that he could find that used the word "hoe" in it. And he came back and he had 22 songs, separate songs that had used the word "hoe," not times used, different songs. And so it amazes me that, you know, people want to take a guy's life and just crush it because of a 5-minute word he said. And I dare him to say it, to ask him what Imus was talking about before. He said about the Tennessee women before he said about the Rutgers. He doesn't even know. He was just so dang interested in the five words he said after that. He didn't even pay any attention in context to what was being said. And I find it that, you know, everybody wants to wreck people's lives over something people say. It's a free speech country. You're right. The government can't ruin us. But you have people in certain segments. You got Al Sharpton, who regrettably was able to run for president in this country after what he said about the Jewish community in New York.
Okay, Peter. And, you know, your phone line is messing up a little bit on us. But we got your point. You're a free speech advocate. You maybe the mood is changing in the country. A word like "ho" comes up in music and. I don't know. Maybe it'll be acceptable someday. It already is in some circles. John Pavlik, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I mean, I think the media certainly are at least in part responsible for the growing use of the sexist terminologies that are, you know, replete in music. But my point earlier was that whether those songs are changing the viewpoints of the listeners is an issue really for research, and not one that is necessarily the case. It may be that, at least in part, that reflecting attitudes that are already out there.
Yeah, let's take a quick break, and then right back with John Pavlik of Rutgers University, who's with us to talk about the Don Imus story. I'm Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Don Imus, syndicated radio program host. Imus in the Morning suspended from that job for 2 weeks starting Monday because of remarks made. He's on the circuit making his apologies. We don't have him, but we do have John Pavlik of Rutgers University. And speaking of Rutgers, the women's basketball team came in second. They were the subject of Imus's remarks. Has there been a response yet from Rutgers University officially, or from the team or coach? John Pavlik?
Well, yes. The president of the university has responded, indicating that he thinks that his show should be canceled. He should be removed from the show, and that's been sort of the response from the leadership of the university.
And from the team itself? Anything? I haven't seen anything yet. Any quotes from players or coaches?
I think the players were instructed to not speak to the media, and I haven't seen a comment yet from the coach.
Okay. With that, Lynn is calling from Milwaukee. Let's go over there. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning. I would like to hear some discussion between you and your guest about some of the earlier comments distinguishing what was said from obscenity. I think maybe the United States has a little bit of immaturity about its definition of obscenity, and if we included violence in that definition against others, we would have more clarity about an issue such as this. Even, I mean, I know that obscenity is not legally defined, but in most places, I mean, it's not a clear issue, but I think that it has very far-reaching social implications when we continually look at obscenity only constricted to sexuality and not to social behavior. And it's not to legislate, but to define, the word obscenity. And if we looked at violence as obscene, it would have, far-reaching implications at home and globally.
Lynn, thanks for that. John Pavlik, is there any move within media ethics to look at obscenity, to widen the scope, as Lynn would like to see, to include things like racism and violence?
I don't think so. I think that it's an excellent point, though, that in fact one could argue that there's far greater damage done by some of the violent, imagery presented in media in general, or some of the racist imagery presented, than is necessarily the case from sexually explicit content. But I have not seen any move in a significant way to try to get that that concept redefined to broaden it. I think that most media scholars, most educators would prefer to probably limit the definition more than expand it.
And as you train your students as a journalism professor, what do you advise them when it comes to issues of racism and violence in the use of commentary?
Well, what I instruct them to do is they should always think in terms of being responsible and being accountable and hold themselves to the standards that they seek to enforce when they do investigative kind of journalism, and to always maintain their credibility depends on acting responsibly. And so I instruct them specifically not to engage in that kind of racist or sexist discourse and to always try to put things in context.
I imagine you work with students who are actively engaged in journalism, and whether student or professional newspapers or radio stations or television outlets, whatnot. I would imagine also that a lot of those students have Jon Stewart as a hero and come to you with ideas and want to do comedy and satire. Is that true within journalism students? They want to walk that line a little bit?
Sure, and satire is an important part of our tradition of freedom of speech, and so doing satire is you know, it's very powerful and can have a significant impact. But it also, I think, if you want to do it well, it requires some intelligence, and that's one of the hallmarks of you know, Jon Stewart, is his satire is done with intelligence, and I think that's part of what draws young people to his show in particular.
But I guess what I'm getting to, and you maybe can guess, is does it change your advice when talking about these issues of violence and racism and sexism? Can you be a little more edgy within the context of comedy and satire?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely you can be. And there's really no place for it in journalism, in news reporting. But in comedy, absolutely there's a place for it. But there still are boundaries. And the boundaries are based on, in large part, community standards. And that's the way that it's defined in general in any regulatory areas is based on community standards.
Yeah. When you said there are boundaries, at first I thought you meant there are boundaries between comedy and journalism. If that's the case, those boundaries are getting pretty fuzzy these days, aren't they?
No, I think that in news reporting, the introduction of humor is, I think, you know, there's sometimes some humor that's provided in news reporting, but I think that in general, the advice I would have to my students is if they're doing news reporting, that they should maintain a focus on reporting the facts rather than introducing ridicule, say, into their reporting.
Yeah.
But there's certainly a tradition of providing that in political cartoons.
Sure, sure. I just suspect. I have the suspicion that there's some young bucks out there right now listening to us and really thinking we're hopelessly old school. You know?
Well, it may be the future of journalism will have much more integrated comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And humor, you know, the kind of wit that you see in The Daily Show.
Maybe so. We'll see. I can't wait to find out. Let's talk with John. He's calling from Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I think that the guest idea about having MSNBC and CBS do a series on delving into race is a very good idea. You know, these silly little words mean so much. They shouldn't. We need to ask why. He doesn't know that you, Peter, produced a series of shows a couple years ago on racism. And I think you could attest to how difficult it is to sustain a dialogue like that. I have a parallel issue that kind of indicates what would happen. That's the Trent Lott issue about 6 years ago. Where at a Strom Thurmond honorary dinner, he made comments that we would have been better off had Strom Thurmond been elected back in the 60s. And Strom Thurmond, of course, ran on a pro-segregation platform. And it led to Trent Lott being ousted out of his speakership role. But the thing is, he had a lot of support for a long time by his GOP colleagues. And then he mentioned the fact that he was going to see to it that the House did things for minority communities. And no sooner did he say that than his colleagues made sure he was out post-haste. So I think that, you know, you get to white privilege in discussions of race, and it doesn't sell.
John, thanks a lot for the call. You want to comment again on what you said earlier in the hour, John Pavlik, about the idea of this creating an opportunity for network television and radio?
I think it presents an excellent opportunity because it you know, and it's a case where striking when the iron is hot makes the most sense. And so they should take this time to immediately start addressing the issue and to do so on an ongoing basis. I think that to do it in a variety of venues would make sense. and to encourage the dialogue to widen and to include not just race issues but also gender issues.
What do you expect to see in the next couple of days in the media? I'm going to ask you to do a little crystal ball gazing here for us. This is the kind of story that will certainly not go away quickly. What do you hope to see in the next couple of days?
Well, I'd like to see, or I think we'll see.
I guess they're two different. I guess they're
talking about it and providing a much more of a widening, not to focus exclusively on IMUS, but to look at other cases and to look at where race and gender have been flashpoints in other areas of the media, and to then provide some discussion that might broaden it to other parts of society.
Yeah.
That's where most benefit could come of this.
I guess really I was asking two different questions, what you hope to see and what you expect to see. So that I take is what you hope to see. And
I'm an optimist about what I think the media will do when they, there's a lot of very smart and very responsible people who work in the media.
Yeah,
and I think that they'll see what is the mandate here. One of the problems they may have at the networks is that the exact stipulations of IMUS's contract, for example, may make it very difficult for them to fire him. I heard IMUS say that if he didn't think he should be fired, and if he were fired, there would be, he said, consequences.
Ah, okay.
So he was, standing against the networks in any possibility of him firing, and basically, I assume, implying that he would file some sort of legal suit against them if they did that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what his contract may stipulate, so I doubt that there'll be anything beyond a two-week,
And maybe some suspension. And maybe some impact from advertisers that we talked about earlier. Chad is in Toma. Hi, Chad.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I don't know. I've been on the phone for a while. My thoughts keep changing, but I think I'm going to come down on the side of your free speech friend. Although I don't believe people should talk that way, I don't either. And I know a lot of friends of mine don't. I know some people that do talk just like a jerk. I mean, there's no other way of putting it. And that's what Amos is. I don't listen to his show, and so what? And I think it's almost offensive that we're spending an hour talking about this guy and what he said. And I would like to see the president of Rutgers say, we don't feel we should even, that's not worthy of a response, and then just drop it. I think that would be the way to go.
That would be an interesting response, wouldn't it, Chad Pavlik, if it was met with just total silence from everyone? That would be pretty powerful, too.
Well, it would, but at the same time, I think one of the problems with that is it would suggest to people that, one, you're kind of willing to accept it.
Yeah.
You're willing to tolerate it. And two, that you're weak.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you're not going to support your students of color. And your women, your female students.
I think that
would send a message that would not resonate well.
Yeah, there is that response though that I think Chad is suggesting the kind of shrug your shoulders. It's like it's not even worth it. He's an idiot. I'm not even going to waste my breath on him. And if everybody kind of said that in unison, that would send a message too. But I hear you. Let's get one more call in. Laura from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Laura. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment was just that along with – I'm a firm believer in freedom of speech, but I'm also a firm believer in the responsibility to protect that and to have behavior that is appropriate and think about what we want to teach our children, especially from the standpoint of, the celebrity impact, how much, our children see from that and how we, taking those cheap shots.
Laura, I'm going to leave it there because our time is just about up, and I want our guest to have the last word. Rights, with rights come responsibility, John Pavlik.
Oh, absolutely, and I think that there's the two points I would emphasize that we want to teach our children is that we do want to value and preserve freedom of speech, but at the same time, there are boundaries, because there's those that right conflicts with other rights, and so we need to always be thinking in terms of the consequences of our actions and temper them based on, you know, those possible consequences.
And finally, you wouldn't want to see any kind of culture of fear in the media as far as self-censorship, but you do think there is a way to have this responsible communication without creating that culture of fear, right?
Absolutely. I think the media need to take swift and decisive and strong action so that there will be no momentum for government action, because I think that's the worst-case scenario.
Okay. And with that, we're going to say goodbye, and thank you so much for joining us at the last minute this morning.
My pleasure. Thank
All right.
you.
Take care of things in Rutgers. John Pavlik, professor and chair of the Journalism and Media Studies at Rutgers University, our guest this hour. Thanks to on-air producer John Tretter today and Rhonda Fanning, who produced the program. Back in this chair tomorrow, and I'm looking to see what we're talking about now. I don't have the notes in front of me. I guess we'll have to find out together. Listen for the promos later today. They'll be airing throughout the day. I'm Peter Donalds, in for Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. News is up next, and then more on the network. Thanks for listening.